This is the Hidden Killers Podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Brian Koberger.
It is indeed, and we're going to dig into some of the newly released evidence that was unearthed by the reporting of Dateline NBC. Joining us is Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author. To help us separate the calculated from the compulsive and the creepy from the clinically relevant. Siobhan, based on what Dateline has revealed, and we have some clips we'll watch here in just a few moments, Koberger searches about how to go about life here. His fascination with serial killers like Bundy, his repeated trips near the victim's house, how much of this looks very much like premeditation versus some sort of impulsive obsession. And what can those behaviors tell us about his underlying psychology? There's a lot there.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, one of the things that I was waiting to hear was, what kind of porn is this guy into? Because it carries tremendous significance when you're dealing with people, who have sex accusations of sex offenses. You want to get into their internet history. And so what I heard is that he was looking for porn related to women who were drugged, sleeping, unconscious. And that, you know, that's kind of a red flag.
It's obviously a genre out there for some rather disturbed individuals, but it's out there. And the fact that he's looking at it, and he has pictures of women on his phone, the defense is going to argue, look, he was a 20-some-year-old guy. Yeah, he's into some kind of weird porn, but that doesn't make him a killer. There's plenty of guys who are watching porn, and there's plenty of guys who have pictures of busty young women on their phone. That'll be the simple defense. But when all put into context, does it tell us a different story?
Yeah, it sure does for me. And the pictures on his phone, you know, big difference if this was, a girlfriend or someone that was consenting to having their photo taken. Mm-hmm. But if he was sneakily snapping photos of people, and that was the sense I got, these were not people who he knew that, you know, were willing to pose for photos for him. That's another red flag that makes me concerned, is people who are sneaking photos of other people.
Yeah, and I don't know how much it was him sneaking the photos as much as it was going onto other people's Instagram accounts and such and just
taking the
photos down, which in itself is a bit of a weird thing to do.
I prefer not to see people getting photos that way. There are enough legitimate ways you can look at photos of attractive women, online, people who have posted things there, but going into other people's personal stuff and taking their photos is, to me, that's something that disturbs me. I would want to look at that person more closely.
Yeah, without a doubt. And that's the thing. And we've learned that some of the photos are Dateline has reported and has learned that some of the photos are of fairly close friends of people that were in that house. We don't know all the details yet. I'm sure it will come out in court. But the fact that the web goes that far. We don't know if there was anything with the actual victims there. But I mean, what does that tell us about what's going on here? Was this kind of, is he working? I mean, allegedly, you know, he's innocent until proven guilty. But if, in fact, it is him, is this someone who's kind of working their way backwards to get forward to where or to the people they want to get to by going through friends and kind of working it that way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it speaks to me of somebody who had a fixation, who was cyberstalking, who was apparently, according to the data about the car being in the vicinity, was physically stalking. Mm-hmm. And all those things paint a picture that, as the DNA has led back to him, that confirm that.
Another thing that was going on, and obviously we've heard about it too with the searches, and it's part of the search history, looking up a lot of Ted Bundy. Yes, obviously he is a criminology student. So I guess not that extremely crazy of a possibility, but when you consider the striking similarities, although Ted Bundy had a charisma about him, Koberger does not at all.
Maybe he was aspiring. He wanted a little bit of Bundy's charisma and didn't have it.
It's like Bundy without charisma is basically what it is. But probably someone that Koberger might have looked up to. I mean, that's just speculation. Mm-hmm. But especially when you put it all into context with that picture at the end of the day, and that's the one we've talked about so many times, the one in the shower with the thumbs up. That seemed to be... amongst other nods to Bundy as well, with Bundy's mm-hmm. thumbs up photo. What do you make of all that? Is this something? Is it show us anything? Does it give it any weight in court that he was looking up Ted Bundy prior to the murders taking place?
Yeah, in and of itself, it wouldn't necessarily mean anything. A lot of people are curious about Ted Bundy, all the movies that have been made about him, books written about him. You know, it's sort of like... something freakish that people want to understand. But I think, again, it's everything in context here, and taking photos of himself, selfies of himself in the same manner as to look like Bundy. Again, it just puts a layer of creepiness on all of it that, you know, it's another piece of the whole picture that I think does carry weight.
It's quite an extreme thing just to jump in and go, I'm going to kill four people or kill anyone in general, just to go from zero to that. I'm going to guess there was some buildup here and there may have been some fantasizing going on. There may have been some, I don't know, test runs in a certain way. Maybe that's part of the car circling the house all those times. But even deeper than that, Dateline reported on a very interesting piece of behavior, and that is that of Koberger helping out a fellow teacher, a fellow teaching assistant, who he became kind of friends with, a female that also was in the same apartment complex as he shared. The story goes that she came into her apartment one day and her cosmetics were lined out on the counter where she did not normally put them. Nothing was taken. It was just very odd to see that because nobody should have been coming in and out of the house. She gets scared. She reaches out. She tells her friend Brian, who she sees every day, and then he becomes the hero. He comes in, helps her set up a security camera, has access to the Wi-Fi password, has access to the security camera password. And she looks back on this going, oh, God, was he studying me? Was he following me? Let's talk about that for a little bit. Obviously, she was not one of his victims in the sense of murder, but a victim in another way. What do you think is going on there? What is going on in someone like Koberger's mind that he's going to carry out behaviors like that?
Yeah, that's a really chilling one. And, you know, guys who go on to become serial killers often start with stalking, with voyeurism, and with breaking into women's homes. Sometimes they steal an undergarment or something that they think won't be missed. And so when I heard about her cosmetics being lined up in a particular way, my brain took me to also, well, he has OCD tendencies, which are pretty well documented at this point. And did he just think her bathroom was too messy and he felt this urge to have to straighten everything up for her, you know, mm-hmm. which may be absurd and it may be true. Who knows? Yeah. But, you know, clearly for her then to turn to him for help. Wow, what an opportunity for him to gather more information and video possibly of her. So pretty scary.
As non-socially skilled as he is, he seemed to be skilled a bit in just kind of the mechanics of life. Because when you just look at the cause and effect of this, most people aren't going to think if this happened to them, that their cosmetics are lined up weirdly on their counter, that the person you're asking is the one who actually did it. That's just not something that would normally go through one's mind. But it's a real simple thing to do. I mean, you really just look at the mechanics of it. If you want to be the hero in somebody's life, well, instill a little bit of fear mm-hmm. and then be the person that's going to help take those fears away. That seems to be exactly what he did. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it doesn't necessarily then play into the murders, though, either. Is that more just like a control move? Is it a confirmation move of, look, I can get away with this, and then just kind of a step up to more and more extreme behavior?
Yeah, and getting away with things is exciting. It's sort of like the prelude to the big thing, which is going to be the killings. But there may have been some things that she never missed. That he, who knows how many times
sure.
he had actually been in her apartment and what things he may have taken that were missed. And we don't know how many times might he have done this to other people, these kind of low-level burglary, stalking, voyeuristic kinds of things. My guess would be that he had been doing this sort of thing for years.
Is this sort of
and just never gotten caught?
Is something like this, is that compulsive? Or I mean, is that calculated? And when I say compulsive, meaning like he has little control over to whether he's gonna do it or not. It's the thought gets into his head and it's just this urge that he can't quench. Is that the kind of thinking that some of these people have?
I'd say it's like addiction, you know, mm-hmm. where somebody ruminates about something, they fantasize about something, they sexualize it, so they're masturbating while they're thinking about it and fantasizing, and the idea of going into someone's personal space, they get a sense of power, you know, that they can sneak around and do these sort of things. And so, you know, it's a good question. At what point do people have control over their addictions, and when do they not have any control? I tend to lean on the side of they've got control, but it may feel very much like a compulsive urge. But, you know, I have a compulsive urge to eat ice cream. I mean, mm-hmm. that's as severe as I get, right?
Yeah.
But I just don't keep it in the house. I can manage that urge because it's in my best interest to not be sitting there eating ice cream all the time.
Yeah, I mean, every time, you know, when I see you, when we first log on to this, you always have to put the ice cream bowl down. And I know there's a lot
it's
of times
hard.
You're like, you're
it's
trying
hard.
To sneak it between yeah. between questions. But, you know, I get it. It's a battle. Let's watch some clips here from the Dateline episode. And I want to talk about what happened to Ethan Chapin. And I don't like getting gory or anything, but it's simply just part of this case. So we're not getting into super detail, but this is what happened to Ethan. This is, again, from Dateline NBC and their reporting on the Koberger case.
When you're dealing with crimes that are motivated by anger toward women, the men that are in the way are rapidly dispatched.
Then, according to our sources, the killer did something strange. He carved Ethan's lower legs. Carved is the specific word that was used.
If you view that person as having gotten in the way of what it is you're trying to play out, you might be overwhelmed with anger toward them and do something extra. And I think it's a clue that there was a sexualized component to this, because this was about women. There was a special anger toward that male.
It looked like the killer sat down after that, said an investigative source, and left behind impressions in blood on a bedroom chair.
He's exhausted. He's gone through four people.
People that commit mass murder don't anticipate the adrenal exhaustion that's going to overwhelm them when they do it.
I want to talk about specifically Ethan's, the word carving. Mm-hmm. On his legs. Ethan was someone who, I mean, at the end of the day, didn't pose a threat to Koberger. He killed Ethan when Ethan was sleeping. Basically hit his carotid artery with the neck. And then I'm sure Ethan probably woke up for a few moments and then died, probably very unsure of what the hell was going on. And then after that, had his leg carved into mm-hmm. by Koberger. It's not one of the girls. Mm-hmm. What does that say about what Koberger was feeling about Ethan?
A tremendous amount of rage, obviously, and it makes me wonder if some of that wasn't about Ethan was the kind of person that Koberger could never become. He was someone that had a girlfriend that was loved by everyone who knew him. We don't know how much Koberger knew about him in advance, but he probably knew something about him. And this, you know, in that way, he became symbolic for everything that Koberger wasn't, and that could have spurred the anger. We've talked before about Koberger kind of fitting the model of an incel, mm-hmm. and incel men are particularly rageful, not only at women and at beautiful women in particular, but they're rageful at successful, attractive men as well.
Yeah. And that's the thing in that community. They have like names for it. Is it is it Ken's? Is that what they call
Chad? Chad and Stacy.
Chad's. Okay. Yes. Chad's and Stacy's. I was thinking Barbie for whatever reason.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's
Chad's and Stacy's. And that's something we don't think about all that often. We don't talk about all that often. We often think about these are men who are, they're so rageful because they can't get the women, and the women find them utterly repulsive and creepy because they are utterly repulsive and creepy.
Yeah.
But they can't quite figure out why. So it's everybody else's fault except their own, including the males. And that's an interesting thing when it comes to this, because you don't see them necessarily going after the men, at least that we see often in these cases. It's them going after the women with that hate and that spite. Is this a rare case where we see, if he is kind of an incel type thinking guy, that a man physically went after another man in a jealous rage as well because of not being able to be like them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there was the case down in Santa Barbara, California, with Elliot Rogers, who was the incel, who identified very openly as being an incel. His initial goal was to take out a whole sorority house full of young women. They locked the door on him and he couldn't get in. So he then went around town with a gun and his BMW and was running into people. And he killed quite a few young, attractive men in this killing spree. So I think it's like, well, if you can't get the Stacy, then go for the Chad.
Oh, and just incidentally, there's that profile online that and people go back and forth and if it was him or not, the Papa Rogers, which seemed to know information, but nobody else knew, and seemed to be an odd little homage to Elliot Rogers. It wasn't Papa Roger, it was Rogers, which is rather interesting. Let's watch another clip from Dateline talking about the mind of Koberger and some of his apparently chilling fantasies. Let's take a look.
He's clearly trolling and getting stimulated by looking at people who in his mind fuel the fantasy.
And with the trial just weeks away, how will his attorneys defend Brian Koberger with the death penalty hanging over his head?
How do you mount a defense to all that stuff?
Piece by piece. And if one card falls, then the house can fall.
Do you think the house can fall on this one? Do you think that there's any chance here that Koberger is going to have some sort of story or alibi that's going to put reasonable doubt in the mind of a jury from what we know so far?
I cannot imagine what it would be. I just can't imagine. And I've tried to keep an open mind.
Yeah.
But there's just so much evidence here. And we haven't even heard all of it at this point.
No.
So it just, to me, looks absolutely overwhelming.
Let's do this clip. This is an interesting angle, and I'm curious to get your thoughts on it. We're, of course, talking about, you know, minds of people who kill like this, serial killers, and what they do leading up, how they get themselves in the mode that they're going to go into. Let's watch this clip, and we'll talk on the other side.
Koberger watched a video on his phone containing this quote. It read, "Something is wrong with me. I can't be who I need to be. Something is wrong with me. Will it last for eternity?
It doesn't fit into society."
Then, later that morning...
How you know it?
How y'all doing today?
The Kobergers' father and son were pulled over in Indiana.
He was right up on the back end of that van.
Not once, but twice. We're following too closely.
Just make sure you give yourself plenty of room, okay?
3 days after the Kobergers arrived back home in Albrightsville, Pennsylvania, the FBI had traced the DNA on the knife sheath to a geographic area, the Northeast, then to a family, the Kobergers, and finally settled on a likely suspect in the murders on King Road, Brian Koberger. Later that week, two more selfies of Koberger in a black hoodie showed up on his phone. And as Christmas came and went, a source close to the investigation has confirmed.
So there's two things there. Let's talk about the what he was listening to on his phone. I believe there's actually lyrics to a Britney Spears song. And it was a twisted, it was a slowed down, creepy version of it as well that he was listening to. Wow. A lot of people in their lives, let's just take normal human healthy behavior. They look today, it's memes online. It's like self-affirming memes. And, you know, it's this is good and this is great and God's doing this or I'm doing that or whatever. It's okay. Yeah. Yay. Rah, rah. Positive. If you're someone like this and you don't feel like that, I guess you may surround yourself with content that speaks to how you feel. Is that, you know, as simple as what that is?
Yeah, I think people often use, you can tell a lot about people about what do they listen to over and over and over again, right? And it's not necessarily, well, if you listen to this kind of song, it means that about you, but it means something. And we don't always know what that is, but I think it's, again, it's another piece of this. There's something wrong with me when you go back to all his internet posts where he was writing about, I don't feel connected to other people. You know, this is a guy who was isolated and knew that he was different from other people, but doesn't seem to have the wherewithal to alter much about his personality. So just, I think if we got into the brain of Brian Koberger with enough finesse, which we don't really have, you know, neuroscience that can do that at this point, but I think we would see that this is somebody that, yes, there was something wrong with, and there had always been something wrong with him.
And that's what I'm wondering about. It was, because what's interesting about this is Koberger himself put it out there when he was much younger in those internet postings about talking about the visual snow, about not feeling emotionally connected, about not having any sort of empathy, about treating his dad like crap, as he put it, and saying that he doesn't know why he does it. He can recognize that his dad has done so much for him, and that his dad is a good guy and doesn't deserve to be treated that way. But Koberger seems to have difficulty not treating him that way. He seems to be kind of struggling with it and can't quite figure out why. And to everybody on the outside, you go, well, just stop being an asshole to your dad. You know, it's not that hard. But that seemed to be really a bridge too far. Why do you think that is? Why would that be a struggle for someone? What's going on in their brains that just being a decent human being to another person that treats you with respect be so hard?
Yeah, this is the lack of empathy. And we do know that people with psychopathic personality, that there's a biological component to it, a huge biological component to it. And it has to do with the wiring between the amygdala and the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. That's the empathy center. And in normal brains, those two parts of the brain are well connected, and that allows us to have empathic attunement and connection with other people. Some people are born without it, and we can't blame them in that sense. It's like, it's, you know, you were just born with a faulty brain, and they can have enough wherewithal to stand back and say, okay, there is something different about me. But just knowing that they're different doesn't mean that they can overcome it, because they just are not quite right.
And that's the next question. Is there overcoming that? Had, you know, he was being a red flag for himself. Hey, there's something wrong. There's something wrong here. Had he gotten the right help, and I'm not saying that he didn't. I mean, it seems that he did go and get diagnosed and all that. I don't know what exactly his parents did when he was younger. I don't know what he did. So I'm not trying to fault them by any means, but just in theory, does a person exist? Is there something out there that would have existed that could have fixed Brian Koberger and this broken brain, if it's him and if it's the way that we seem to see it as being from what he's been presenting?
You know, it's really, really hard to answer that. And my guess is that he had a lot of support from the family. That looks, you know, it looks to me like they're good people. He probably, as we get the whole story of his background, he probably did have a lot of extra help. We know he had treatment when he was in the, you know, the substance abuse program. So it's a wonderful philosophical question.
Yeah.
Can you do anything about a person who has a brain that is simply not structurally normal? Mm-hmm. We like to think that if you get kids at a young age who have these kind of psychopathic traits, and you can at least teach them how behaving differently toward other people will benefit them in the long run, that you can at least shape them to some degree and turn them in a more pro-social or positive direction. But I don't think we really know. And I don't think that there's any data to prove that you can take somebody who was really born with deficits. And in his case, it's alleged, which is completely reasonable, that he has autism. But I would say, in addition to autism, you can be psychopathic and sadistic and have autism at the same time. One does not rule out the other. So this is somebody that just really no fault of his own was born wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, things were just not quite right for him. And I think it's really important for the families. Imagine the torment if you really were a wonderful parent and you did everything right by your kid. Mm-hmm. And then you have a kid turn out like this and everybody turns and looks at you and points the finger and says, what did you do to him? You know, I just don't think we can go there because there are things about the brain we don't understand, but we do know enough with brain imaging that, whoa, some people are really different.
What do you think the conversation was on the phone calls that he made to his parents the morning of the murders? Because that was revealed on Dateline as well, that shortly after, when he got back home in the early morning hours, there was two phone calls to his family home in Pennsylvania. One was, I believe, 20-some minutes. The other was 40-some minutes. Mm-hmm. We don't know what the content of those calls was. If, in fact, he did this, like I said, would have just been hours after these murders took place. It would have been right in the timeline next to where he's doing the thumbs up selfie and right before he gets back in the car and then does another pass at the house. Is that a happy, peppy conversation, you think? I could actually see it being more of that than it is any sort of down and out. Clearly, I don't think he confessed to his parents or anything like that. No. But what would you imagine that conversation to be?
I think he was in a terrific mood. I think he felt powerful. He had fulfilled this fantasy that he'd had for months, if not years. And whatever the content was, we don't know. But my guess is his mood was elevated and he was peppy. Good word.
And it's interesting when you look at all of this peppy, happy. He was also, according to his students, very laid back after these murders took place. Suddenly there was a very different Koberger in the classroom. It wasn't the very hard-edged and difficult to work with and difficult to be heard with Brian Koberger. This was someone who was suddenly grading papers on a whim and giving everybody great grades, not being super critical. What does that say about it? Is that part of the euphoria of I'm in a great mood, so who cares about this anymore? I don't have to worry. I mean, what is that?
Yeah, it was like the act of the killings, this thing that had this pressure that had been building up for so long that he was so fixated on. It was like just a release of that tension. Mm-hmm. And so you saw this less intense guy.
One more clip. This is about Brian's attempt to make some friends at a pool party. From Dateline, let's take a look.
A partygoer observed that at one point, Brian Koberger became fixated on two young women dressed in bikinis. Fixated was the word our source used. But one of the women was married and gave her nearby husband a nonverbal signal, rescue me. So the husband approached Koberger and the women jumped into the pool. But we're told that Koberger didn't take the hint, brushed off the husband, moved over to the edge of the pool, near the women. It was all very off-putting, the partygoer would later say. It was the very next day, the day after the pool party, when Holly's cell phone buzzed. A message from Brian Koberger.
The wording of the text as I look back on it is kind of peculiar.
Here it is, the actual text sent July 10th, 2022 at 1:19 p.m. Quote, hey, I'm pretty sure we spoke about hiking trips yesterday. I really enjoy that activity, so please let me know. Thanks.
It was almost overly formal. I really enjoy that activity, so you know, can you follow up with me about that?
So did Holly, in fact, let Brian Koberger know about plans to hike, as he had asked? No, she did not.
There's not really a good explanation.
Yeah, so you got two things there. He's totally either missing or ignoring the cues at the pool party. And also sending out really weird worded texts that just don't quite seem human to them. Mm-hmm. Let's start with the pool party. And was he missing the cues of the men saying, hey, you know, this is my wife? And, you know, most healthy people would be like backing off pretty quick, either embarrassed and scurrying away or just like, hey, you know, sorry, man, I didn't know. And most men would be like, it's okay. I hear, you know, whatever. But he just kind of kept going full throttle. Like, I don't care that you're here. I'm attracted to you. Walk me through the mind process of what someone like a Koberger, if in fact this is him, would maybe be thinking at this moment in time when he's approached at the pool by the husband of the woman he's gawking at.
One of the things about autism, which is kind of one of the hallmarks of it, in fact, is the difficulty with mentalizing, which means the ability to put themselves in someone else's point of view or else's shoes. And so in that way, it's very much tied into empathy. And it sounds like, again, things that would be completely normal to you or I, that he just didn't get it. He just didn't see it. It didn't register. So that's how I would make sense of that. Again, it goes back to his brain just doesn't quite pick up on signals the way the rest of us do.
He's unaware that he's creepy when he's being creepy.
Exactly.
And that probably is a major frustration to him. I mean, that if you just think about that for a second, if the actions that you just thought were like just normal, like you're just going about your life, and then suddenly everybody's like, oh my gosh, that's really creepy what you were doing and what you were saying. And you're like, what do you mean? Like, I have no idea. But never taking the step back though either. And that's a choice point too of, oh, well, this is new input. Maybe I should adjust my behavior.
Yeah.
If I'm not good at picking up on it, maybe I should learn from that. And
exactly. Exactly.
And it seems he didn't choose to do that. It seems the choice was more so it's everyone else's fault and constant frustration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And clearly, this is a guy who was really sexually driven too. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so much of this inappropriate behavior is around women and, you know, women that he considered attractive. So I think when we talk about the contents of his mind, he was thinking about sex all the time, and he was very frustrated and increasingly over the years entertaining these violent, you know, sadistic kinds of fantasies.
Is it an effect of basically being like this, where you're creepy and you're putting off women and they seem to just be repelled from you like an opposite end of a magnet? Does that drive that sexual fantasy and that sexual desire even more just because you've had little to no success with it your entire life? And that's like the one thing that you want at, it's the one thing you have like zero skills at getting close to, and you actively are pushing them away and you don't even know why.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you nailed it exactly. Yeah. And increasingly angry about the fact that, you know, that's the classic incel line. All the Chads get all the Stacys and we're just left out, and that's not fair. So we're going to kill them all.
Yeah. It's an amazing world we live in, and the way some of these minds work or don't.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.